All right, so I'm really reducing my ambitions. Only two things, but they're two really cool things that I want to talk to you about today. So one is just kind of continuing and finishing up on the discussion we started to have last time. When we start to think about Higgs production and decay at LHC, just want to kind of finish that and complete that discussion, because the properties of the Higgs is a very hot topic now, and people are really working incredibly hard on just essentially improving the precision by like a factor of 10, maybe a factor of 100 over the next decade to 2 decades. And during your research lifetime, if you do this sort of research, that'll be a very, very hot topic. So I want to just get that story down for you in the standard model, the basics, so you're oriented and finish up on that. And then I want to start switching gears a little bit and start talking about another very important source of information about the standard model, where we have an enormous amount of information coming from something called flavor physics. So that's the study of baryons and mesons and how they change and decay. And that actually, there's an enormous amount of physics in the standard model. We've just been focusing on essentially the electroweak sector, the SU2 cross U1, and properties of Zs and properties of Higgses and Ws. But the properties of the quarks and the bound states and how they actually change and how they actually are studied experimentally is an incredibly rich program for like 60, almost 80 years. And in the next decades as well, the amount of data that is going to be studied there, and there's a very rich program there, is really enormous. It's really a remarkable thing that's coming. So I just want to start orienting you on that. And you'll see in this discussion, I hope, if we get to it today, how it's so related to what we talked about in terms of the initial discussions on when you had parameterizations of just masses that were present in the theory, Goldstone bosons, and also the whole discussion on custodial symmetry and how it's like so directly related to the kind of symmetry breaking that's in QCD, which is what is basically starting to talk about chiral perturbation theory. So that's the plan, and we'll see if we get through all of that today. It might push into tomorrow a bit. So just to remind you, in terms of production and decay, we started to talk about production from bound state objects like protons, okay? And then when you have bound state protons that you're smashing together to create Higgses and then decay, or other states and then decay, then you have to worry about the fact that these individual states that go into the hard scattering you'd write down in a Feynman diagram are embedded in this bound state wave function for the proton. So there's something called these PDFs, parton distribution functions, which are literally just how these individual states that would be involved in the hard scattering are embedded in these wave functions. There's a whole series of them. We have to just measure them experimentally. But what they do in terms of the phenomenology at LHC is incredibly important in terms of what we actually see and what we can actually measure. So just to remind you, there's these functions, and then we have hard scatterings, and we basically integrate over the momentum fraction of these individual states 1 and 2, state 2 embedded in proton 2 in this collision, state 1 embedded in proton 1, and there's this momentum fraction in each case, which is literally just a number saying how this four momentum is related to this four momentum. Okay? So if we know these and we can calculate this hard scattering, then we actually get the production, and also we can also calculate the decay. Okay, so I was talking to you about a particular case, which I want to go back to and kind of finish up on, which is glu-glu Higgs, because it's the dominant production mechanism. So we talked about last time how this diagram leads to an effective coupling of the Higgs to two gluons. There is no dimension four coupling of the gluons to the Higgs in the standard model, but you do get this at one loop, where this can be any kind of quark running around, but there's this Y top here, which is an order one coupling, to give me a big contribution. And you can think of this in terms of decay, or you can think of this in terms of production. Now, part of the reason I was talking to you last time about decay was I wanted to really illustrate the importance of the PDFs in terms of essentially how big this effect is in terms of production. Okay, so you have this decay width, and it's alpha s squared gf mh cubed 64 square root of 2 pi cubed. And then it's this sum over these fermions that are in the loop. And this will be just a function which you'll see shows up in multiple places. And this is just what's an example of a loop function, this f1 half. So it basically just is doing these momentum integrals in closed form. And out of that comes this result, which is that it's -2. It's the same for all the fermions. I won't use that notation. I'll just make it a function properly. So it's -2 tau for the fermion -2, tau for this gun, 1 minus tau. And then it's either multiplying arcsine squared, square root of 1 over tau, or it multiplies -1/4, and then this complicated log function. One minus tau, one minus square root of one minus tau. And then this is I pi, and this thing is all squared. And this is what you get if tau is greater than one, which is the case for the top. And this is what you get if tau is less than one, which is the case, for example, of autumn, which also happens. And tau was 4 m, whatever the fermion state is, divided by the Higgs mass squared. Okay, so just because the top quark is 176 GeV and the Higgs is 125, this is greater than 1 for the biggest contribution to this loop from the top quark. So if you just want to do that expansion, it's always nice to do these expansions, as I've tried to emphasize over and over, then this just becomes a -2, essentially. Okay, it just simplifies. So that tells you that you should be able to, doing this expansion, get a simpler expression, because when you do any expansions like this, in the case of the standard model, or if there's other physics that it could be running in this loop and shrinking down to a point, then when you do this expansion, it really localizes things. We had a discussion on that. To a point, and then you get an operator and because this is dimension 5, you have to make up the mass dimensions. If it's a standard model matching, then it comes from standard model interactions and the mass scale is set by V. Okay, but as it stands, you could just say this is just an operator which has a coefficient which we don't know, but we can say in the standard model what it is, and over lambda. So what this actually is in the standard model, if you just take the amplitude here and just literally do the expansion at the start. Now remember, that one of the benefits of doing this sort of thinking is you can expand before you integrate. So expand at the start in momentum, making this localized to a point. And then what you'll get for this is directly, for the standard model, it's equal to a simple expression alpha over V, and then 12 pi, okay? And then there's contributions which you can get, which you can actually calculate alpha squared, you can calculate higher order contributions in, you know, expanding out in terms of the Higgs mass being smaller than the top mass. But this is just what you get for the local contact operator, okay? Now, this is another example of an operator that in the standard model you can get, but that also you could have effects from physics beyond the standard model, right? If you have any physics beyond the standard model, whatever it is, if it's in a loop and it's much heavier than the Higgs mass, then when you do its, you know, Taylor expansion to get its low energy effects in terms of how it's going to affect the phenomenology we see for the Higgs, it'll just shift this coefficient, right? Because it's going to match, it's going to land on this operator form, because it has to, there's nothing else it can really land on in terms of its low energy effects. And then it'll just shift this coefficient, it'll get an extra contribution. So we talked about a couple of operators, and I'm just trying to make this clear that there's a bunch of these things. So we have L standard model now, and we've talked about this operator, which was dimension 6. And that there was this operator, And now we have another one, which can have effects from physics beyond the standard model. We're going to test this stuff. This is written as dimension 5, but if you want to write it in terms of dimension 6, then you write it down as just simply this. So there's more of them, but you can see they're starting to accumulate a bunch of these sorts of effects. Where it's useful to think in terms of these local structures in the standard model, but also physics beyond the standard model can impact these things and shift these coefficients. And what we do when we experimentally are probing the properties of the Higgs is we're really just having the standard model predictions, and then we're seeing if there's any, you know, room in the experimental results for these things to be non-zero. Okay. It's a very active effort right now in terms of experiment. Okay, so how does this actually work in detail? Can I skipped a board. I guess I'll just shift over to this board. So in detail, what you actually have, just so you can see like the full result, this was just the decay. And the discussion on the decay I thought was easier simply because you knew from Z to K how you have an initial state, setting the mass scale, which is this mass scale in the case of the Higgs, and then just decays to the gluons, and we integrate over all the final state gluon stuff. So the PDFs, which I was emphasizing is so important in terms of production, is not involved in this story. Okay, but you can see that if you take this to be a local structure and shrink it down to a point, then when you have production or you have decay, it's the same local structure shrunk to a point, it's the same coefficient, okay, in the standard model or in other physics beyond the standard model. So it's still this value. Okay, so how does it actually work in the production? In the production, you have to do this integration over PDFs. And what you actually get is the following. So you get the standard model GGH production. And then you have this momentum fraction. We're making an on-shell Higgs, so it's fixed, you know, production at the mass scale of the Higgs. So where Z is defined as mh squared over the partonic S, where S is this P1 plus P2 all squared. This is the partonic S value. Then you're essentially fixing this to be on-shell production, exactly making the Higgs mass on-shell. Okay? You're just having enough energy to make exactly a Higgs. And the same coefficient comes in. So it's a pi over 4, and then this CHG standard model all squared, and we know this, I wrote it down for you, it works out to be alpha s squared 4 times 144, if you work it out, v squared over pi at the end of the day. So times this z delta 1 minus z, z delta 1 minus z. So what you have to do is you have to take this expression, we know p1 and p2, we write it down in terms of x1 and then the big P, which had the proton, x2 and the big P, which was the proton, to relate it. And then we have to know these functions, practically speaking, to figure out how many of these we should see. These have to be measured experimentally somehow. Well, we do that convolution integral and we get a number in terms of what we expect in terms of the number of Higgses we should see produced this way. And then we test experimentally to see what happens. Okay? So is that all clear? Hopefully that's clear. Okay, so what about other production mechanisms? So what else can you have? You have these protons going along, and you can have splittings. And one of those splittings, for example, could be BB bar, the B quark. Right, so there's another simple, very tree-level, this was a one-loop effect, right, in terms of the standard model. You have this tree-level coupling, which is just this hard scattering, right? And even though YB is 10 to the minus 2, and remember YB was the square root of 2 MB over V, and the beak quark is 4 GeV, and this is like 246. So even though this is incredibly small, when we're competing against loop effects, it's not obvious which one will win, right? Because loops 16 pi squareds down stairs and small couplings. So again, if you want to describe this, you have to do PP to the Higgs. And now it's going to be specifically not the gluon PDF, but the B-quark PDF. And then you need to know essentially this hard scattering in the standard model for BB bar ghost H, which is quite trivial because it's just a tree level diagram from the Yukawa. So you just expand it out, take the amplitude squared. Okay. So it works out in terms of numbers that this guy is is much, much, much bigger than this one. It's a bit surprising, perhaps, but it's the effects of the PDFs. The proton is actually creating an enormous amount of glue that is actually going into the scattering, so that these functions are much more suppressed. Remember also the fact that you're starting off without a B quark as a valence quark, right? So you have to make them so they come from small perturbative corrections. And these are much, much smaller than the gluon PDFs, so that you get this hierarchy in terms of the production. It's the exact opposite case in the story in the case of the Higgs decay, though. So it gives you an idea that the difference here is not due to intrinsically the amplitude squared. If you compare the decays of Higgs to BB and Higgs to glu-glu, it's the other way around. Higgs to BB decay is much bigger than Higgs to glu-glu decay in terms of the branching fraction. But the production, because you convolute over these, they're incredibly hierarchical, and the gluon initial state PDFs win. Okay? All right, so I wanted to go into a little bit more detail. So the actual numbers here is, this one is 52 picobarns, whereas this one is 0.5. picobarn, just in units. You can see it's order of magnitude. Okay, so what are these barns and such? So just the basics of colliders. Okay, so these are just kind of weird units we introduce. 1 centimeter squared is 10 to the 24 barn. So it's a unit of area, and I think it actually is historically because people were making jokes about hitting the broad sign of a barn or that sort of thing. That's why it was actually introduced. Okay, and that's equal to 10 to the 36 picobarns. Okay, this is where you get these big SI units. So the number of events in any sort of collision that you get is going to be the cross section that you actually get when you do this integration over the PDFs, and then you have to multiply by the overall number of collisions itself in the collider, so it's the integrated luminosity. So we've gotten about 140 inverse femtobarns in terms of integrated luminosity at LHC so far. And we're, in the next decade, two decades, we're going to get up to about 3,000. So this is going to get, you know, another order of magnitude. So there's a lot more in terms of data to come, and we're not just going to see this dominant production mode in great detail in terms of statistical sensitivity. We're going to start to see this subdominant one a lot more precisely, and also the other decay, the other production channels. So the other production channels, so what other production channels are there? Well, It's just a matter of Feynman diagrams at the end of the day. This. Oh, I forgot to mention it. The glu-glu production is gluon fusion. This is the way we usually refer to it, okay? So this is vector boson fusion. Okay, so now we have initial state quarks. So those can be like valence quarks for the proton. So that's actually helpful in terms of those integrations that we have to do over PDFs. But then this comes with a small gauge coupling. Okay, so where does this come from? It's just coming from d mu h dagger d mu h, which has contributions of this form. And similarly, there's contributions of this form going to the mass eigenstate field. Okay, so it's quite straightforward. It's just a tree-level diagram. You just have to do the momentum fraction integration for this initial state quark and use this vertex, and you have the two propagators. It's a very straightforward calculation. And at the end of the day, just for comparison, so when we go with vector boson fusion for the Higgs, this is VBF, then we get 4.08 picobarns in terms of the size of the production cross-section. Okay, so hierarchically, it's a bit bigger than the B quark production, and it's much less than the gluon. Oh, that is specifically for W. No, sorry, I had that right. Okay? So there's one other sort of major way we make the Higgs, just to finish this discussion for completion. This can be a W or a Z, a W or a Z, right? So we can actually have the two quarks in the initial state fuse to make a W or a Z and throw it off and then have a Higgs. This is called Higgs-Strelong. This is like Bremsstrelong. And it again just comes from d mu h, d mu h, but in this case, you just get so you have to have a v to make up the dimensions, and we get z mu h. G1 squared plus G2 squared for 2 with a V. Before I was just writing the Feynman rule. Well, actually, I wrote the H explicitly here. You can just take it, you know, explicitly write it down in terms of mass dimension being 1, or you can just drop it from the Feynman rules. You've seen that convention. It gets a bit confusing, perhaps, for scalar fields. Okay, so you can just, is there some dimension 1? You can explicitly write it or not, but usually we don't explicitly write it, and this V makes up the dimensions. Okay? All right. So in this case, and X where you're having either a W or a Z also produced, then you get 1.45 picobarns for WH, and you get 0.94 picobarns for ZH. Okay, so you can see that glu-glu wins by a lot, and all the other ones are down similar in magnitude. And then it's just a matter of how you can actually identify the final states in terms of the scattering for the decay, to isolate the production channels in terms of cuts that you do, to actually see which of these is the ones that you're going to be studying for particular measurements that you're doing. Okay? All right, so that hopefully is clear. And I just wanted to say a couple of things for comparison on Higgs decay. So you can see the importance of the PDFs and also how the hierarchy of what's important changes completely. Okay. And then hopefully get on to chiral symmetry breaking stuff. Okay, so for the decay of the Higgs, we talked about this one in detail, right? So I don't need to write it all down again. This one you saw in terms of production was orders of magnitude smaller because of the PDF effects. But actually, in terms of decay, it's the dominant product, it's the dominant decay mode by far. So it gives you an idea of the intrinsic size of the amplitude squared versus the integration over the PDFs. It's just equal to 3mh over 8 pi, and then it has mb squared over v squared. And for other final state quarks, it just goes with the same, except for the mass of the quark changing. And the 3 is an integration over color, because you're summing over the color final states. Okay, so this is, if you look over here, I was trying to draw this ahead of time to give you an idea. So when it comes to decay, 125 GeV for the Higgs in terms of mass, you can actually calculate the individual decay widths compared to the total decay width, which defines something called the branching fraction. And if you look closely, I'm sorry, this is not the cleanest thing. I didn't want to waste time lowering and putting down the screen. If you look closely, this is a branching fraction. So it starts at 1, and this is like a log plot in terms of what I'm trying to show you here. And this dominant curve is BB. Okay, so even though order of magnitude smaller in terms of production for the production mechanism, for the decay, it's the dominant part of the branching fraction. So almost all the Higgses we see go into BB final states, which then form things like jets and bound state objects. Cleaner sort of decays are much, much smaller. The W and the Z are actually, when you go through W's and Z's to get to 4 final state fermions, which can be quarks or leptons. This can be W, Z, W, Z. So that's what these mean, right? Summing over all the final state leptons from the 4 body decay. They're smaller. Glue-glue decay, which we talked about, with the production quite a bit and also the decay, you can see it's actually not too small. And, you know, the fermions scale the same way. And then there's this one, which is actually quite interesting, which is gamma-gamma. You can see here it's very small. It's like a 10 to the minus 3 branching ratio for the actual mass of the Higgs that we found. Even though it's so small and it's a loop effect, it's actually one of the key ways that we found the Higgs in the first place, which might seem a bit weird to you, but let's talk about that for a second to make that clear. Okay? So, yeah, did I want to go on? Yeah. So what is Higgs to gamma gamma? So it's, you should think of it, it's quite similar to the gluon, right? You can have tops like this, and you can have gammas, because the tops are electrically charged. But it doesn't just have that contribution, you also have the fact that you can have and there's also this 4-point function that comes out of d mu, well, comes out of d mu h with w's, internal w's, okay? So it's all of these guys and also all the other fermions added up and squared. That is what will give you the amplitude for Higgs to gamma gamma. Amplitude squared. So this is an example where you have a non-trivial interference, right? Which actually matters in general in field theory and in quantum mechanics, but this is one of the cases for the Higgs where it actually is a non-trivial effect. You have to calculate this, it's a complex number, you have to calculate this as a complex number and add them up and then square them, right? And then you can have interference, you can have cross interference, right? Destructive interference can happen. Okay. So what is this? So the actual answer is alpha electroweak squared GF MH cubed. This should look exactly like glu-glu decay at this point, with a slightly different number, 128 square root of 2 pi cubed. And then, not surprisingly, it's the exact same loop function, right? All you're doing for this vertex and this vertex is you're just rescaling it to the electric charge as opposed to gluons, right? So it's the exact same loop function here, which is what we wrote down as F1 half for all of the fermions. It matters that you have color running in here before we pulled it out for gluons. And you also have the electric charge for the coupling to the photon. And then you have another function, which has to do with these ones. And it's all squared, okay? And you can get destructive interference between these two contributions, okay? It's actually quite small. It's 10 to the minus 3 in terms of its branching ratio. But it's actually a very clean final state because we see photons very well in the detector. And so it's actually, it was a key discovery channel for the Higgs. It's actually one of the ways we first saw it, because it was like a resonance peak you can actually see. Okay? So just for completeness, let me just write down this F1 for you. Are you okay? Okay. So F1, tau W, is 2 plus 3 tau W, 1 plus 2 minus tau W. And then the same function F that we defined before. So this function F, did I leave it in here? It was literally here it is. It's right here. It's literally this part of the answer. Okay, so it's the exact same function f. Okay? So it's this again. But with now tau w as opposed to tau for the fermion. So the tau is this the same sort of thing. It's this momentum fraction. Okay? So even though this is 10 to the minus 3, it's actually the key way we actually saw the resonance structure of the Higgs. Have you ever seen the bump in terms of like product, you know, in terms of publicity photos for the Higgs, in terms of finding it? That's exactly where we actually were able to see it. Okay? So just for completeness, I've been talking always about operators. What operators can lead to these sorts of effects for Higgs to gamma gamma? So we had these. So this one actually can lead to Higgs to gamma gamma as well. All right, this W3 field and the B field, you can rotate to mass eigenstates, and there'll be a gamma gamma component that comes out of here. But it's not just that. There's also the possibility of lambda squared, and then CHW, which is H dagger H, WA mu nu over lambda squared. Okay, so now we're starting to see there's quite a few sort of operator forms we can think about. This is just going to give one of the Higgses, when one of the Higgs becomes a VEV, one of the Higgs becomes an external state, it's a local contact operator, and we can rotate, there'll be a component here which is gamma gamma in mass eigenstates, similarly for here, and also this one. Okay? So all three of them, you know, give contributions to gamma gamma. All right? But you can see we're starting to stack up with more and more operators. And if we have physics that's heavier than the standard model states, when it localizes to a point, it'll have to essentially land on different coefficient values of these sorts of operators. Now, if you remember from like a week or 2 weeks ago, this also showed up in predictions for the two-point functions for the properties of the Z. Remember when we were characterizing the properties of the Z and the masses, the mass differences? This showed up and this showed up. So this shows up not just in how the Z mass is related to the other input things you can measure, it also shows up in changing Higgs to gamma-gamma decay. Okay, so once you start to think about looking for effects of physics, extending the standard model, you'll get these correlated effects in different observables for the properties of the Higgs and electric precision data and the properties of the Z. This is a good example of it. Okay? So this is the sort of thing that happens in a characteristic way. Okay, so I've been trying to emphasize like a data-driven, I'm gonna have to talk about Carl symmetry next time. Well, I'll start talking about it maybe. A data-driven approach. So how many, does anyone actually know? It's actually kind of interesting. Humankind has spent a lot of money, time, and effort to make Z's and Higgs's. How many have we made? A lot less than, you know, beer and that sort of thing, but what do you think? Do you know the numbers?
40.
Much more.
More?
Yeah. Any ideas?
1,000.
1,000? You're getting close. Yeah, for Higgs's, it's kind of on the money. So the things I talked to you about so far, LEP, remember that large electron-positron collider? That actually made, in like a six-year time frame, 18 million Z's. Okay? Now, for Higgs's, LHC, we actually made 10 million so far H's. Not bad. Pretty good. However, you know, so far, and we still have more years to go, like 20 years to go. However, the only ones we've usefully been able to actually measure and actually interact with and learn from, so we actually measured and basically studied the properties of a subset of these, which is only 50,000 H's. Much smaller than 10 million. So what's going on, right? I mean, we're spending, this is what we're absolutely fixated on. Why are we not taking every single one of these we can and studying them? Well, for comparison, the event rate is just higher. So you know how many Z's we've made at LHC so far? 2.8 billion. So far. Just to give you an idea of the raw numbers, right? You need to actually see these event rates. Okay, but that's not the problem. What's the problem leading to this sort of thing? Well, there's lots of ways of seeing the problem, but one of them is just this number. So one of the really nice decay modes of the B, of the Higgs, was into two Bs, right? That was the dominant branching fraction, okay? But there's also an awful lot of this that happens in the standard model. It has nothing to do with Higgs's, right? But it's just QCD, right? And also initial state gluons leading to this sort of thing. So how many of those are there? How many Bs have we actually made? We've actually made 40 trillion so BB bars, essentially. That's the problem. So this is, you know, a much, you know, a great increase in the number of these states that we're making in this amazing machine, but we're doing an incredible amount of QCD scattering involving bound states of QCD in the final states, like this forms a B hadron or pions. And there's just so much more of that that we have to basically do special cuts on our final states to isolate the production of the Higgs compared to the things like this that are happening. And that's why, even though this is insanely small in terms of a branching fraction for gamma-gamma for the Higgs decay, it's actually one of the best ways we're gathering statistics on it because it's so clean. Because we don't have that corresponding diagram with gamma gamma from just pure QCD. Okay. So this should hopefully make clear to you that if we are going to learn about the states that are really interesting involving electroweak symmetry breaking, then we need to know a lot about Bs and Bs coming in B mesons. We need to know a lot about pions. We need to know a lot about kaons and all of these bound state objects of QCD, which actually show up in this production and decay at LHC in huge, huge, huge numbers. So we have to have an incredibly precise understanding of how these states work, okay? Which are bound states of QCD. So I'm trying not to go over, and I think it's actually a good point to stop. So that's what I'm gonna start talking to you about next time, more on QCD and bound states. Oh, do I have 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I'm going to go into chiral perturbation theory. Okay, sorry. I was just trying. I've been going over too much. I've been really didn't want to go over today. Okay, cool. Let's talk about mesons and start to talk about mesons and see how far we get. Okay, good. So you might not love them. They might not be like really exciting, like the Higgs and that sort of thing, but they're absolutely an enormous source of information on the standard model. So we have to understand these states really well. Maybe you'll love them. I don't know. Does anyone love the pion? You love the pion? Okay, that's great. That's glad someone.
Kaons are better though.
Kaons are great too. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's move forward and see how far I can go on Carl's symmetry breaking. Okay, so pions, let's start there. Well, they can be U bar U or D bar D. It's actually combinations of these that we're gonna derive, show up in terms of the definition of the pion. And they're about 130 MeV in terms of their mass. And there's also charged versions of these. And the they're either UD bar or D bar U, and they're very degenerate in mass. They're just off by a couple of MeV, which is the constituent masses of the quarks. So kaons are much larger in mass, but we know that if we just start thinking about ups and down quarks in QCD, if we have this sort of mass scale around in terms of their masses, and if the constituent mass of the up and the down, remember they were just a few MeV, like 5 MeV. So we have a nice expansion parameter in neglecting the masses of the quarks themselves to start with. Just expanding and using lambda QCD as the scale that's roughly giving this mass. And then we'll do perturbation theory in terms of the hard masses that the quarks have. Okay, so that's our strategy in terms of understanding the properties of these states, in terms of what they are, in terms of their in terms of how they show up experimentally, in terms of their mass degeneracies and stuff. So we mentioned this before, but LQCD part of the standard model Lagrangian okay, so we're going to write this down. It's got its kinetic term. And of course, just like in QED, this is just the classical or tree-level Lagrangian. We would have to renormalize everything. It'll have counterterms just like in the QED case. We're not going to talk about that yet. Talk about that later. But it will have counterterms. Okay, so here, we're going to start talking about Q, which is a triplet of these guys, all the very light quarks that are light compared to lambda QCD. Okay, so Q can be up, down, strange. It has an index for that flavor, 1, 2, 3. Okay, so it's a triplet, and it has a mass matrix. So this MQ is diagonal. So the key thing we're going to be doing is we're going to say, well, for these very light quark masses, these are smaller than the scale of lambda QCD, which remember was like hundreds of GeV, say like 400 or MeV to say a GeV. And we're going to expand in the small masses compared to lambda QCD. Okay. So in that case, that's going to go over to having both the left-handed field separately propagating. Okay, so we're breaking up in terms of the masses. The masses where we're combining the left and the right-handed guys up, right? So now we're taking the mass goes to zero limit, so we'll have individually the propagation of just the mass of the left and the right. So we talked about that before in terms of it having a larger symmetry. So that's going to have the transformations of these guys. There's an SU3 left transformation, and there's an SU3 right transformation individually. So these guys were, you know, triplets, so we can just rotate them around individually and separately. So it's an SU3 left cross an SU3 right. Okay. So let's see. So we can, well, let me just be explicit about that. So you can have a transformation on the left for these Q lefts. And a right transformation for these SU3s. So there's also a baryon U1 that's around, right? Because you can have a baryon number associated with this. So there's a U1 that can cancel here. And there's also an axial baryon, current that's around. So the baryon U1 is just a U1. So it's just an overall phase. And then there's a U1 axial, which is just going to be these transformations by the left and the right with an opposite phase. Okay? So the U1 baryon is just going to be this with the same phase. And the axial is going to have an opposite phase. Okay, so these are things that are just conserved in this, these terms, the way we're writing down the Lagrangian to start with. Okay, now we talked about the idea of a partial symmetry. So you take L standard model, and then you kill some terms. Only some terms preserve a symmetry, okay? But here, this is there's an example here of something called an anomalous symmetry, right? So this symmetry is something that is just there classically or at tree level in the Lagrangian, but it is not preserved when you start to do loop corrections. So it's just an accidental symmetry that seems to be there classically. When you start to do loops, you cancel. You kill that symmetry off. It changes the measure in the path integral. Okay, so there's two different things. One is just partial symmetries, where even classically at tree level, you have to kill some terms in the Lagrangian. Remember, custodial symmetry was a version of that. And now this is an example of another sort of symmetry structure, which is that you look at the theory at tree level, it looks like it has a certain symmetry, but if you do loop corrections, it doesn't preserve the symmetry. So it wasn't a true symmetry of the theory. Okay, but you just accidentally, it looked like it was a preserved symmetry at tree level. But the theory is only defined with its counterterms and with its loop corrections. So if you actually were to write down the theory involving all the loop corrections to start, you would have never thought it was a symmetry to start with. Okay, it's just kind of a fake that you didn't do all the loop corrections to start. Okay, you're looking skeptical. You skeptical? Question?
Oh, I have a question about the terms.
Which terms?
So like Q1 is a triplet, right? Gauge boson is, we have 8 3 by 3 matrices.
Yeah.
how does gamma's look like?
The QL is a triplet in color and also triplet in flavor.
In flavor as well. So these are the flavor transformations. That's why I was writing it like this.
Yes.
So there's other indices I've suppressed. The QCD index is also around, or sort of the color charge index is also around, right? Is that your question, or?
The question is gamma matrices, because it's left, right? So LQCD should be scalar eventually.
Yeah. But what are you worried about? It's the flavor space. Remember, like the gamma matrix is like to do with space-time.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, U it's okay. U itself is like for
mu.
Yeah.
Is an index which is 1 to 4,
yeah,
which has to do with the space-time structure of the theory, and then the gauge fields carry that index mu.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so this, like, you know, the internal flavor groups, all these internal symmetry groups are called flavor groups, right? They just factorize from the space-time structure for the slash and the gamma mu. Yeah?
So the gammas we use in the slash are like 2 by 2 gammas, or
Oh, here? Well, this is, yeah, remember these are the left and right, so there's a projector sitting around. So they're going to project out some of the components of the four-component spinner.
So what we really mean is like Q bar left 0? That's what they mean, like?
Q bar left.
Yeah, because I think there it's like the gammas are 4 by 4, if I'm not...
Yeah, this is when you actually have the mass terms. That's why they got an index of left and right. That's the projector for the left and right projector.
Yes.
So this is a four-component spinner.
Yes.
And these are two-component spinners. Because in the mass limit, we break things down into both the lefts and the rights, which are the individual helicity components of the spinners, which decompose separately.
And plus, it's meant to be like a D-slash for like left is like Pauli matrices slashed and...
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the usual covariant derivative.
Yes. No, it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah,
you could just... The way to think of it, like to really deconfuse yourself, is just put a P left explicitly, right?
Okay.
Then you can go back and talk about the other ones, the other Q fields over here. And the only difference you can see in this case, remember P left and P right were 1 plus gamma 5, 1 minus gamma 5. They only hit the gamma space, if you will, or the gamma mu, like the Dirac structure space of the theory. They go through everything else.
Yeah, it's fine. Thank
okay. How am we doing for time? Okay, I still have some time to go on. Okay, so hopefully this will now pay off. Remember when I talked to you about custodial symmetry? And remember in custodial symmetry, what was the analogy, which is exact here, well, pretty much exact. Remember in the case of custodial symmetry, what we had was an SU2 left cross an SU2 right, and it was breaking down under a VEV to an SU2 vectorial subgroup. That was the custodial symmetry story, remember? And that was just in L Higgs. Remember, we introduced a field that transformed on the left and the right in such a way it had a separate SU2 left and a separate SU2 right transformation. So it had this in terms of this potential sector of the theory. And then when the Higgs got a VEV, there was a diagonal VEV that broke down to a diagonal subgroup of SU2, okay, where the generators of the left and the rights were identified. Okay, so the exact same thing happens here. It's the exact same symmetry breaking pattern, other than the group being different. So in this case, we have this SU3 left cross SU3 right, but we actually are going to break down to an SU3 vectorial when we have a vacuum expectation around, but it's not the Higgs vacuum expectation value. Okay, so this is going to be a vacuum excitation value of the quark condensates. Okay, so the individual QQ bars. Okay? So the analogy is quite direct, but in this case, in chiral symmetry breaking, then we basically think about the expectation value of Qs. I'll do my indices more carefully. Okay, and we basically introduce something which I'll call V prime. This is not the Higgs VEV. Okay. But it is a VEV. Okay, it's just an expectation value that's around. And it's a diagonal expectation value, right? So we should expect, in a very similar story, it'll break down to a vectorial subgroup, and that's exactly what happens. Okay? So V prime, remember these were mass dimension 3/2, mass dimension 3/2. This should be mass dimension 3. Okay? So it should be something GV cubed. And what's leading to this condensate? So in the case of the Higgs, there's like a VEV that we put in by hand classically in the Lagrangian. We're not putting in a VEV by hand classically here. We've gotten rid of the mass terms, which do have to do with the Higgs VEV, with very small Yukawa couplings. So this is an expectation value that's being generated by the theory. And the only option we have on the table is it's an expectation value generated by QCD, right? It's QCD leading to bound states. That's actually breaking symmetries of the theory. Okay, so that's exactly what's happening. So you should expect this to be of order lambda QCD cubed. And that's exactly what it is. This is due to QCD. So it's spontaneously breaking the symmetry structure of the theory, introducing masses in this way. Okay? All right. So, good. All right. I already talked about stereosymmetry. So how many broken generators do we have? Well, we had an SU3, we had an SU3, 8 generators. There's still 8 here, so there's 8 broken generators, right? Which QCD, this vacuum expectation value is spontaneously breaking, and then we have 8 Goldstone bosons. We're gonna parameterize around this vacuum, around the minimum of the theory, and that's gonna be exactly what are the pions and the kaons in terms of just parameterizing the Goldstone fluctuations, the long distance fluctuations. So again, like in the case of the symmetry breaking of the Higgs, when we actually had masses and we were parameterizing, introducing masses by hand, we introduced this sigma field. You remember the sigma field, which was the exponential in that case of the Pauli matrices, which then gave mass to the W and Z. So we're going to do the exact same thing here. We're just going to have an exponential field that we're going to introduce, sigma. It's a field, and it's going to parameterize the symmetry breaking. So we're going to define it to be the exponential. We're going to introduce a scale f, which is different from lambda QCD. And then we're introducing this matrix M, which was just in the case of the symmetry breaking of the standard model for the masses of the W's and Z's, the Goldstones there. Those were the Pauli matrices. But this is a matrix which is going to parameterize the 8 broken generators of SU3 left cross SU3 right going down to SU3 vectorial. Okay? And so what M is, it's exactly this in terms of how we define these Goldstone bosons parameterizing around the vacuum. It's the pions and the kaons. And it etas. Okay. Minus pi naught over square root of 2 plus eta over square root of 6 k naught k minus k bar naught minus 2 eta over square root of 6. Okay, so it's just basically you take the broken generators, you parameterize the fluctuations around the vacuum, and you call some parameterization some particular fields, which is what we identify as the pion and the kaon and the eta. Okay? So these terms, when we're writing it, the theory down in terms of the sigma field, you can derive directly from the effective theory, so the chiral symmetry breaking theory. And it's just equal to F squared, this scale we introduced here, which is going to normalize the kinetic term, so we just write down first the kinetic term in terms of the sigma field. This is an exponential field, again, like the case we had before when we talked about electric symmetry breaking. But we can always write down a kinetic term like this. And then the mass terms that we're going to introduce in perturbation theory, we're going to write down terms like this. This is this V prime. This is again the sigma field. Okay? So we're just parameterizing the fluctuations of the states around the vacuum in terms of first the kinetic term, and then this is the mass term, which is going to break explicitly the symmetry by introducing the masses, the degeneracy. Otherwise, these are massless Goldstones. Okay? All right, so far so good. So I'm over time. Damn it. I didn't want to go over time. Okay, I will continue next time on from this point. I really am trying to knock over time so much. But let me stop there. Are there any questions in terms of this? Yep.
What did you write for the denominator in the exponential for sigma x?
It's just an f, a scale f, which is exactly this f.
Okay.
So as it stands, it's just a parameter. It's of something mass dimension 1 that we introduce. So it turns out that it's useful to introduce both the scale f and the scale lambda QCD in terms of chiral perturbation theory. They're actually related roughly by 4 pi, but we'll talk about that more. Yeah. So it's just a scale that we introduce at this stage. This is mass dimension 1, so we're going to make up the mass dimensions. Okay, so you should probably see that the symmetry breaking story is you know, quite analogous. It's quite directly similar in terms of when you have in a large symmetry group and you break down to a vectorial subgroup in both cases, it's going the same way. So it's kind of like universal physics that hopefully you're seeing is showing up in multiple ways in terms of the standard model Lagrangian. Yep.
So how do the quarks get a WEF? Is it like some perturbative correction or not?
Just the bound state structure that's formed of order lambda QCD. So QCD, you know, we basically don't have free quarks. So if you try and separate them, you can't isolate one individually without infinite energy. So the bound state structures correspond to what minimizes the energy of the system. Okay, and so that means that, you know, in the vacuum space of the theory, there's going to be a lower energy minimum where the quarks are bound, which QCD is selecting for. And so QCD is generating this vacuum expectation value just because it's leading to these bound state objects.
So can I actually compute this V prime, or is it like...
No. No, it's a non-perturbative parameter. It's parameterizing the you know it's of order lambda QCD. So it's just parameterization at this stage. But you know it's, you know, dimension 3. I don't want to go over. I'll just start next time talking more about these guys, and then we'll talk a little bit more about flavor physics in terms of meson mixing and meson decays and that sort of thing. Okay? Okay, I'm going to stop there.